Coming up today, VR on an epic scale, HBO gets hacked, and the sound of global protests gets mapped. You're listening to the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Vicky Turk.
Hi.
And that's it, actually. Everyone else isn't here. I feel like every time I send an email at the moment, I get an out-of-office auto reply. It feels like the whole city of London has gone somewhere. But we're still here, just the two of us, and we'll be joined in a little bit by Joao Medeiros to talk about the new Premier League season. But first of all, Vicky, what did you learn this week?
I have a bit of a morbid fact for you this week, because I learned that the smell of the human body liquefied is similar to that of steamed clams.
Steamed clams. Which Simpsons fans will remember. Is it steamed clams that Principal Skinner tries to make for Superintendent Chalmers? I think it is. Anyway, digression. How do you know that?
So this is from a feature in the current issue of Wired magazine, actually. It's a fantastic feature. It's by Hayley Campbell, and it's all about a new potential way of dealing with dead bodies, which is essentially dissolving them, but it's a bit more technical than that. Ooh.
Yeah, it's strange.
Yeah, and it basically kind of dissolves the body and just leaves the bones, which, you know, you can then kind of keep as ash, similar to cremation.
Great. Yeah, it's a morbid feature, but a fascinatingly morbid one nonetheless. And we didn't even ask you to plug it, so there we go.
Well, that just stuck with me, that little fact.
The smell of clams. Human clam juice. I learned. I stepped on a slug the other day, and I felt very bad for it. And I thought, gastropods. That's a weird name. Gastro. That means food, or I thought it did. It turns out gastropod literally means stomach foot.
Wow.
When you think of what a slug is, basically just a big slimy foot.
Stomach foot.
Yeah, it's a stomach foot. There you go. So it's an animal that's so simple, its name pretty much describes everything about it. Slugs, gastropods, stomach feets. Our first story, it's going to be a long show. It's not. Our first story this week, Vicky, earlier this week, you went to a rather large-scale virtual reality experience.
Yes, so that is a perk of working here at Wired, is we sometimes get to try out cool stuff. So I went to try out some room-scale virtual reality, which is pretty much what it says on the tin. It's a VR experience in a room, which means that you can walk around. So while you've got the headset on, you appear to be walking around in a virtual environment, but you are actually physically moving your legs and walking around a real-life space.
So this is the kind of virtual reality experience, as they put it, that people can't possibly have at home because no one has a room that they can dedicate to thousands of pounds worth of VR equipment.
Yeah, well, not many people can. So this is intended, I guess, for sort of VR arcades or maybe pop-up events, that kind of thing, where you can deck out a whole room and just go in to try it out. I guess similar to like an escape room or something. Those kind of experiences, or immersive theatre, it very much was drawing on those kind of events.
So what was the show? What did you experience?
It was an early demo of an experience called Vanishing Act, which is made by Found Studio in London. And the premise is that you are travelling through the memories of a scientist who has, I think he's disappeared. And he's found a way to digitize his memories. So you, the person in VR, are exploring further back in time through his memories. And the aim is to kind of pick up clues along the way. And then in the final version, because it's not finished yet, I think you have to kind of unravel a secret password or something to sort of complete the experience.
Now, I think maybe Roland, who's also not here today, has played a great deal more VR than a lot of us. But everyone on Wired, I think, and probably a lot of our listeners, have stepped into a virtual reality world at some point with mixed results, I'd say. Some VR demos are very good. Some are just plain awful. Where does this sit in the broad spectrum? Is it good?
I thought this was really good. And I am a bit of a skeptic when it comes to VR. I think having the room scale so that you can actually walk around was really effective. That's sort of what you imagine when you think of virtual reality,
right?
No,
it's what they show in the adverts.
Yeah, you can interact with this virtual world. You're not just sitting down with a heavy headset on, kind of looking at things.
Mm.
And so it's super immersive. It was using the Oculus Rift, and so it had the Oculus Touch controllers, which means you can pick up and drop things in the virtual world. So there was a really good bit where I was in this forest, and you have to pick up a torch and then you shine it on bits of the forest and you can only see the bit that the torch is shining on. So just little things like that made it really effective.
Mm.
And I found myself, you know, even though I'd seen the room that I was in, it was just an empty room. When I got to sort of doors that were a bit low, I was ducking my head, or if there was a little ledge, I was lifting my feet. Just immediately, it felt like I was there. So I really rated the experience, and I am excited to see more room scale stuff in the future.
And this, even though it was tethered, so you're still,
yeah,
you've still got a big cable coming out the back of your head, and some poor bugger has to make sure that you're not tripping over it.
Yeah, so that is the problem at the moment with room scale VR. I mean, there are a few problems, but I would say the main one is we need to get rid of the wires.
Yeah, which some VR solutions
are attempting to do.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, the kind of lower end of VR, the headsets that use phones or the kind of less high quality images aren't always tethered. But to get that really great, you know, Oculus Rift style performance, they do still have to be connected to computers. I think some solutions have kind of put the computer in a backpack so you can walk around with it. But again, it's not exactly what you want.
And then there's the HTC Vive as well. So, you know, there's Oculus and Vive and Sony's PlayStation VR as well. But no one's really cracked the room scale thing, partly because not many people, as I said, have the room. But there was a clever trick that they played with the development of this that meant that you didn't need a particularly big space.
Yeah, yeah. So it is clever. So, yeah, I mean, the technology is definitely not quite there yet. So Oculus and HTC Vive both have kind of camera sensors that you have to put around the room to make this stuff work. The Oculus ones that Found Studio was using, they have sort of a maximum space that you can use of about 3 by 3 meters. And that's the space that I was trying this out in. So that's not a huge space. But it was what the kind of experience did was reuse the space in ways so that it felt like it was much bigger when you had the headset on. So to give an example, like I would walk through one doorway and then I'd turn my head. And then when I turn my head back again, a different door would have appeared behind me. Mm. So then I'd walk that way and you kind of, you know, your brain is tricked and you forget that you're just retracing your steps or doubling back on yourself. You feel like you're really exploring a new world.
So it's and I guess that works in this weird sort of you're invading someone's mind dream world, that stuff would appear and the world around you would change.
Yeah, yeah.
But just the use of corners is a really clever thing. If you've only got so much space to play with, just get people turning around a lot.
Yeah, and you can just go like down kind of corridors that keep, you know, twisting and winding. And there's clever tricks you can do as well. So things like, you can move the image. So if someone moves their head, say, 30 degrees, if the picture moves 60 degrees, it feels like you've moved further than you have. So there's lots of interesting ways that you can make a small space feel a lot bigger.
The difference between 30 and 60 degrees does seem like it might get a bit vomiting.
That's maybe,
after a
while. Maybe that's a bit too much. But, you know, little things like that. And there was another effective mechanism they used, which was they had a lift in the virtual world. So I'd get into this lift and kind of stand still, and the lift would be going down, but obviously I was just staying in one place.
It's
but
so
then you've got
simple.
The whole you've got the whole space again, and you feel like you're on a different floor.
This is the, it was great. It sounds like, I mean, this is the challenge for VR, is that the technology isn't quite there yet to let them tell truly free stories, as in, you know, free and open. So they've got to use storytelling in clever ways. So be the devices a lift or turning corners, or people will come up with better ones than that, I'm sure, that allow people to still feel immersed in these worlds. Or even just using the physical world that the people are actually in. So there's I think it's HTC do a demo where they put a very, very small ledge, only a couple of inches off the actual ground on the floor, like a plank of wood pretty much, fixed to the floor. And they get people to walk on it with the HTC Vive headset on, and it's like they're on a precipice. So the image they're seeing is them teetering along a plank sticking out of a skyscraper above a city. And they have people on hand to grab them when they fall, because when people fall, even though they will literally just fall an inch, you know, they wouldn't even fall.
Yeah.
But people throw out their arms and panic and flail and can actually end up completely stacking it. Yeah. So
it is amazing how easily your brain can be tricked by this stuff. I was very impressed, and I think this could be the future of VR, because I haven't been won over by the kind of have a headset at home and sit in the corner and play a game.
Yeah.
That doesn't appeal to me so much.
If we had a penny for every time someone had come on the podcast and said, I think this could be the future of VR. But I think I do agree with you. For the time being, as you say, you gave the example earlier of escape rooms. Well, escape rooms in VR, that could work. That could totally work. Working in a team in VR adds an extra layer to it. So for those sort of hour-long activity-based things or a theatre production, whatever it is, you can probably get people into it.
Yeah. Once the technology is there and you can deal with more people and bigger spaces and fewer blips.
It's getting there. It's a start. You can read a lot more about it. It's, what was it called? It's called Vanishing App by Found Studio. You can read a lot more about it on wired.co.uk. Just have a look around the homepage. It will be there somewhere. Our second story this week, it's the kickoff of the Premier League here in the UK, which you might have heard about pretty much all over the world. It's a big deal. A lot of money at stake, and we wanted to get some predictions. So, Joao, you've been speaking to a company that thinks they know who will win it.
Yeah, they think they do. So the company's called the 21st Club, and they actually use Bayesian machine learning algorithms. So they start with a hypothesis, and as they get more data, they start refining their probabilities.
So this is the sort of technology that's normally unleashed on health data and political analysis,
yeah,
things like that.
It's been used for, you know, all sorts of AI applications at the moment.
Now for the slightly less serious task of deciding who will win the Premier League.
I think football is pretty important. So
yeah, football is life or something like that. So this is interesting, because people will have heard of things like Opta and maybe Prozone being words that have been floating around for a number of years. Mm-hmm. But this is using some of that data, but in a different way.
Yeah, so basically, I believe they use OptaData. So OptaData are discrete events during the game. So passes, who's passing, when do you score the goal, at what moment do you score a goal. So are you scoring goals when you're losing 2-1? Are you getting red cards? And then what happens with the team? So they're using all of that kind of data. They put it into their machine learning algorithms, and they come up with a model that allows them to compare and rank different teams and different players from different leagues. So one thing is to say Ronaldo is the best player in the world, but what happens if you take Ronaldo and place it in some other team?
Right.
What's his actual intrinsic contextual value, right?
Which is quite a weird concept. So they've come up with this list of players from one to God knows how many, and also a list of clubs. And one of the things that they found is Huddersfield, which is quite a small club that's been promoted to the Premier League for the first time, is on their world ranking of football clubs in England. It's only something like the 36th. Best club. So technically it's worse than a club that just got relegated to the third tier.
Yeah, so they got promoted this season for the first time, as you say. You expect them to be at a much higher ranking, but they actually not. They're not looking so great. Part of what happened, so obviously a lot of this data comes from friendlies and the last season, and Huddersfield didn't do so well in the way they were beating teams. So they're beating either for a very small margin, and that goal difference just tells you how dominant a team can be.
And in this data model, that's something that also plays out. Manchester United will be a team that maybe our international listeners are a bit more familiar with than Huddersfield. And the data analysis of Manchester United's performance shows that actually they should statistically struggle more than they did last season.
Yes, actually, they might struggle as much as they did last season, because, as you know, they didn't do so well domestically last season. So one of their problems is their defensive approach. They're a very defensive team. Mourinho's team, Manchester United's coach, is well known for being a very defensive, very conservative kind of manager. He likes teams to be solid at the back. And what happened in Manchester with Manchester United last year was actually a picture of what can happen with a team who's very defensively solid. So they were losing points against much weaker opposition. On the other hand, they did quite well against their top opposition, and they did, you know, they won the Europa League, which is when you're just facing the team in one-to-one competition. So teams who are defensive tend to do much better in those kinds of circumstances.
The interesting thing about, well, there's a lot of interesting things about analysing sports data in this way, but one of the findings that 21st Club made was about the effectiveness of new signings. So apparently 44% of club record signings failed to become part of a starting 11 in the first season, which you might not be surprised by, but also the impact of these signings. So Neymar, the world record signing, a silly amount of money from Barcelona to Paris Saint-Germain, but he will have a negligible almost impact on PSG, especially when it comes to the Champions League.
Yes, so they are assuming that Neymar is going to replace the Argentinian winger Di Maria, who's also a very good player. And on that, you know, man-for-man comparison, Neymar will not bring them as much advantage as you'd expect. PSG are already a favorite in the French league. Monaco lost a lot of key players, so domestically that's not going to make a lot of difference. And in terms of the Champions League, they also think it's just going to increase their odds by 5%, which is not amazing. It is, like they say, it's a brand-building exercise for Paris Saint-Germain. And maybe on the back of this signing, they'll be able to attract other players. But as it is, considering the amount that they spend on the car.
It's quite a lot of money. But it's an interesting new way to look at all of this football data. I think baseball and American football have really shown soccer, have shown football what can be done by paying really, really close attention to data. And Prozone, which is a company from which this was sort of born out of, really showed the way for that.
Yeah. What happened in baseball actually happened after what, you know, the whole evolution of what they call performance analysis happened here in UK. So Prozone actually started more or less in 96. And I think the whole Moneyball story happened in 2003. So Prozone and a lot of the analysts here in UK were actually pioneers way before Billy Beane and the Oakland A's. The use of data, it's still a complex issue. The 21st Club focus only on transfer fees and player evaluation and whatnot. More complex are issues like, you know, how do you construct a strategy around data? How do you evaluate a defensive strategy as opposed to an attacking strategy? So these are issues that are still being evaluated.
So, Joao, who's going to win the Premier League?
Well, according to our good friends at the 21st Club, Tottenham Hotspurs are the favourites at the moment. But with a caveat, they say that all the top six teams do have very similar odds. It's still very early on in the season. Well, the season hasn't started yet, but based on the new players, I mean, Tottenham actually bought no players. They spent zero. They lost some of their key players from last year. So it's still very early on to actually make a bet.
And it's a surprising one because some people might think, oh, it'll be Chelsea or the amount of money that Manchester City has spent, that it just has to be them or Jurgen Klopp will get it right this season for Liverpool. So to see Tottenham there is a surprise.
It is.
You can find out an awful lot more about the interesting methods behind the analysis on Wide.co.uk. There's a really in-depth story by Joao there. Joao, we will bid you farewell now.
Thank you so much.
Other things to go off and do, and we'll crack on with the rest of the show. Our third story this week is about a rather concerning hack, or at least if you're a Game of Thrones fan, or probably more specifically, you work for HBO. So HBO has been hacked. Last week, an unnamed hacking group claimed to have stolen reams of top secret files from the company behind Game of Thrones. And now the hackers are threatening to release even more.
Spooky.
Well, slightly, yeah. In true hacker style, they put up a website with lots of brightly coloured text on a black background and slightly shonky-looking images. So they claim, they initially, so it's a little unclear what they've actually got. Initially, they posted around half a gigabyte of unreleased HBO shows and scripts online. And this week, they posted even more. So the latest leak includes scripts for the first five episodes of the current series of Game of Thrones, the fifth of which won't be aired until this Sunday in the US. There's also thousands of emails, financial documents, and strategy guidelines. And inevitably, they've put out a ransom note, which would cost HBO a few million dollars if they decided to pay it.
I presume that they haven't.
No, they haven't. It's a little unclear what's going on. HBO have remained sort of understandably tight-lipped about all of this. They've said that they don't believe their entire email system has been compromised, and they haven't said how much of the information they believe to be legitimate. And there's been some questions posted online this week by a few people that have been analysing the hack in some more detail. There's a chance that an awful lot of it has been faked, but at least some of it must be legitimate, because it appears, seemingly, again, unconfirmed, that HBO has offered a small amount of money.
Oh, really?
To get the hackers to either back down or shut up or whatever. One folder appears to contain legal documents, budgets, phone numbers, email addresses of top HBO executives and actors. And in true hacker style, the people behind it said, "In a complicated operation, we successfully penetrated into the HBO."
So what do we know about these hackers? It sounds like maybe English isn't a first language.
Well, it can all be quite smoke and mirrors, can't it? Because you'll often get groups pretending.
A double bluff.
Yeah, a double bluff. And we know very little about them. And it's not the first time that HBO's been targeted in this way. They set for the ransom. So the hackers claim to do this sort of thing for a living and have made a lot of money out of it, millions of dollars out of it. And what they want from HBO is, I think, 6 months worth of their salary, which would account to around, I think, $2 million. HBO is probably very unlikely to pay that.
Yes, well, you would be, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Especially if you don't know if they've genuinely got what they say they've got. So, I mean, obviously the episodes of Game of Thrones, probably sort of a big point for Game of Thrones fans, but for the company itself, it sounds like this sort of financial and legal information and the emails are probably a bit more worrying if they genuinely do have access to those kind of things.
Yeah, and to your point earlier about the somewhat garbled English of some of the stuff that they put up online, they also put up a video message. It's all a bit like anonymous style. Mm. A bit
hackers.
Yeah, a bit hammy. They could do with a new color palette, let's put it that way. In, I think it was 2014, wasn't it, when the Sony Pictures hack happened, which was eventually blamed by United States officials on North Korea. So attribution is always incredibly, incredibly difficult. And it remains to be seen, and it may never be seen, what the true goal of getting into HBO in this way was. Are they just a hacker group that's trying to get a big payday? But if they are, why are they being so public about it? And acting a little bit childishly. So they claim that the leak is the greatest of the cyberspace era. And they promise that what they leak will be precious and confidential stuff that blaze your eyes. So it's all a bit confusing, really. But as you say, the leaking of an episode of Game of Thrones online a couple of weeks before it airs would be bad. It would be embarrassing for HBO, and it might hurt them a little bit. But the kind of people, I make them sound like they're bad people, the kind of horrible people that go on torrent sites to get episodes of things before they air on telly, I mean, it will be a considerable number, but it won't be a lot. And the vast majority of people will still sit down to watch it on whichever network carries Game of Thrones in their country. So the real damage, as you said, Vicky, could come from legal documents, emails, when people thought that they were communicating in private. And this is where there's an interesting link to the 2014 Sony Pictures hack. So when North Korea, if it was North Korea, did that, they wanted to hurt Sony. Mm. They wanted to show Sony to be bad. And to a certain extent, they did. So
they upset a lot of people, didn't they?
Yeah, they shut down the company for a little while. They caused it a huge amount of financial damage. And this was to do with a film that Sony was the producer of. What was it called?
It was the Interview, wasn't it?
That was it, yeah. And it poked fun at North Korea in a way that was probably unwise, if you don't want North Korea to unleash its cyber warriors on you. But the attack made public email exchanges between some of Sony's top executives public all of a sudden, including statements that some felt were racist towards Barack Obama, and also details of how the company was lobbying the US government. It's the sort of stuff that any company, well, maybe not the racism or alleged racism, I mean, it's the sort of stuff that if you dig into any company's email systems, you're going to find stuff that they don't want making public. Mm. And that's the real damage that could be done.
I seem to remember there were lots of rows over how much certain actors were being paid for different films as well.
Yeah, it was an awful lot of dirty laundry was aired, and you kind of get the feeling that HBO would really rather that this whole thing went away and that it doesn't have its dirty laundry aired in the same way that Sony did. So it's, as with all of these security stories that we bring onto the podcast, it's only a couple of weeks old, and it's not even old yet. We know very little about it, and there's still an awful lot more to find out. So we'll be sticking close to it and bringing you any new news we have in the coming weeks. Our final story this week: sounds and protest. There's a good chance, well, I hope there's a good chance, that people listening to this podcast have been to a protest in the last, well, the last few months, the last year. There's certainly been an awful lot of political discontent all around the world, not just here in the UK and the United States. And an interesting new collaborative art project is attempting to map the sound of protest.
Yeah, so this is a project called Cities and Memory at citiesandmemory.com. And their most recent venture has been trying to collect sound recordings of protests around the world. So it's led by a sound artist called Stuart Folks here in the UK. And he basically just wanted to capture what he calls the sound of our era, or the sound of our times, which he thinks, you know, is the current kind of political unrest and how that's manifesting itself, whether that's anti-Trump rallies across the US and globally, whether that's Brexit, both sides, you know, demonstrating, or whether it's, you know, more local protests. There's all kinds of things that are included in this project. There's kind of small student protests, there's local issues in different countries, and so
anti-LGBT protests.
It's
across the divide.
He did say that, you know, they are mostly kind of left-leaning, just because the community that works on the project tend to share those kind of beliefs, I suppose. But there's all sorts of things in there, and he says, you know, everything's welcome because it's meant to be sort of a document of our times. So yeah, there are some anti-LGBT marches, anti-Muslim marches included in the sound collection.
But for a sound of familiarity, we've got a little clip of a march on Whitehall. Excitement around Brexit, should we put it like that, was probably at its height. So this is what that sounded like. So it's a pretty familiar sound.
Yeah, so that's the Unite for EU march, I think it is. One of the remarkable things, I think, about this whole project, if you go and listen to more of the sounds that have been captured, you hear similarities between different protests, even if they're on the other side of the world.
Hmm.
That's quite interesting, I think. Even sometimes the same chants, if it's, you know, for example, an anti-Trump rally, you kind of hear the same sort of sayings being passed around, spread through the media or social media, and they end up being reused.
So that's interesting. You imagine maybe 10 years ago, before the rise of social media, of Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and Instagram and you name it, that people weren't so exposed to the sound of protest on the other side of the world. So a Trump rally in America would have sounded very different to a Trump rally in Spain or the UK or wherever it may be. But now that everyone's able to hear these chants and see little clips of them, they're being picked up and you're getting this weird echoing of how people protest.
And share the catchy songs.
Yeah, and almost make kind of the sound of protest becomes more unified.
Mm. Yeah, but then there are also still some big differences. So, it's quite remarkable. I think it's in Poland, there's one that's actually really quiet. And apparently the sound artist who recorded that said, you know, that's just kind of how things are when we demonstrate. We keep things... No, it wasn't Poland, it was Hungary. Sorry, right. I got that wrong. We tend to demonstrate quite quietly, and you know, they've still got banners and they're still marching for a point, but it's just kind of how things are done. And then there's a really interesting one, a Chilean student protest, and in the background you can just hear this kind of clink, clink. And apparently that is the sound of glass bottles hitting an armoured vehicle.
That's really cool. And I suppose, it's not if you're the person in the armoured vehicle, I suppose. Protest peacefully, people. But what's fascinating about this is when you remove yourself from being able to see what's happening in a protest, all these unexpected things start to... You start to hear things in the background that you might not necessarily hear if you're looking at a picture. Your brain is completely undistracted by the visuals of the protest, and you're just really focusing in on what they sound like. So for this, the Collaborative Art Project, as you say, so there's people going to the protest deliberately to record them for this, and then it's they who then remix.
So then, so it's basically people were invited to contribute kind of raw sound files of protests near them, and then sound artists were invited to kind of take some of those files and remix them or use them as inspiration to make their own tracks. So the project's called Cities and Memory. The city aspect is the raw recordings, the historical sound document, if you like, and then the memory one is a sort of more artistic interpretation based on that sound.
The British poet Rudyard Kipling observed of the Danish incursions into England, and that is called paying the Danegeld. But we proved it again and again that if once you have paid him the Danegeld, you'll never get rid of the Dane.
Whether it's right or wrong or not, I still believe that the UK is the best place in the world. Maybe it's not to live, but it's still the best place in the world.
Which is an interesting, that's where the collaboration comes in. And I suppose what you've got is quite a muddled, garbled noise of a protest. And from that, you can draw out like the sound of clinking bottles. And well, what does that sound like to someone that wants to make a piece of music composition, or like a repetitive chant, or these little cues that you can pull out of it? And then, as you say, you've got the duality of the raw file and then someone trying to do something creative with it.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to hear different people's interpretations of you know, different protests. Obviously, these are often issues that people have their own ideas about and care a lot about. So it's certainly quite emotive listening.
So if people want to listen to some of the audio, both the raw files and what they've been interpreted into as pieces of artistic music, go to wider.co.uk. You can read Vicky's story there. Again, it will be somewhere on the homepage. Have a hunt around, or you can find Vicky's user profile, Victoria Turk, I think you are on
the
site.
That's it.
That's right, the full name. And that'll do it. We should say once again, what was the name of the project?
Cities and Memory. So you can hear all of the sounds. They're on a kind of clickable, searchable map at citiesandmemory.com.
So that's probably the easiest way to do it. But read our story too, because it pays our wages. We won't do a quiz this week because Vicky would almost certainly win, because I'd write the questions and then not be able to answer them. We'll be back with a full ensemble of Wired staffers when they all get back from holiday next week. So we'll see you again then. Goodbye.
Bye.